ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When it comes to entertainment, you don't get much bigger or more global. A once-a-year collision of pop concert, costume parade, light show, and geopolitical pageant, with an audience of 166 million people worldwide. I am, of course, talking about the Eurovision Song Contest. And for designers, it represents the largest and most widely seen stage imaginable.
I've played a lot of shows in my life, from smaller shows to, you know, arenas and things like that. And it is by far the biggest stage. There was almost too much that I could have done on it. Even when I watch the performance back, I'm like, damn, there's so many moving parts and so many, you know, like where I'm not looking down and I'm moving to the side, I'm moving to the left. And it's like, you know, I could have fallen in one of those like manhole things, but thankfully the stage was enormous.
Since its first broadcast in 1956, Eurovision hasn't just endured, it has evolved. 70 years of ambition, identity, technology, and theatrical excess. Once written off as kitsch, how much has it shaped the look, language, and scale of entertainment design today? For decades, Eurovision sat on the fringes of Australian culture. It wasn't a shared national ritual. But when Australia stepped onto the Eurovision stage in 2015, things changed. We started watching in droves. What was once treated as a joke slowly moved from the margins to the mainstream. Two creative directors who've helped bring Australian dreams to life on the Eurovision stage are Dan Shipton and Ross Nicholson from the UK-based Black Skull Creative, a studio specialising in spectacle at broadcast scale. Yes, it takes a team. Dan and Ross worked with Australia's 2025 entrant, Gojo, a.k.a. Marty Zambotto, and they are working with Australia's 2026 contestant, Delta Goodrum. Dan Shipton.
She is a gift of an artist because the experience that she brings, the vocal ability, the piano playing ability, everything that she is as this artist that has developed over years, coming to the Eurovision stage where we can hone a performance to probably, she's amazed by the whole process as well. And she is very excited because she's a detail orientated woman. And this idea that she can marry this kind of creativity with the detail storytelling and her ability, it opens us up to the possibility of so much, and it's so exciting. Obviously, the visual metaphors of the sun, the moon, the coming together, they obviously have to be represented. You couldn't ignore any of that stuff. And the idea that she is a musician has to be represented, and who she is and what she embodies. So you will, you'll get this amazing story, and then the finale crescendo is truly jaw-dropping, and we'll make Australia proud.
What does it mean to you both to participate as designers in this huge thing that is Eurovision?
I think it's an absolute privilege because being part of Eurovision allows you to hone your craft to such an extent that you can get into every detail of a performance that you don't ever get anywhere else in our design world. And we work across obviously multiple shows in different environments, all, you know, with the same output, which is creating a big TV moment. But ultimately on Eurovision, the whole system is set up to allow your creativity to completely shine. So it's a pretty special place to create in.
For me, like, it's the creating on such a grand scale it means so much. It's really inspiring, and to it, like Dan said, to a privilege to get the opportunity to do that. And I think what's really interesting about doing it on this scale and for a competition is there is that competitive aspect, and the creativity in the staging has such an impact on how a song's viewed, how an artist's viewed. It's like, it's one of the main, you know, factors that people look for. It's, can the person sing? You know, is the song good? How is it staged? It's like, to have that much impact as a designer is really exciting and really inspiring.
When you meet a talent like Delta, for example, how does the creative process start? Where do you begin? What's the conversations like?
Well, the beginning, it has to be, as always, the music. That is the anchor to everything. We're here to visualise and translate a song onto a stage, and so that has to be the anchor to everything. So the first thing that we want to know is, what does it sound like? What are the parameters that that gives us? What are the emotional context that feeds into our ideas? And then from there, I guess we always like to connect with the artist and hear more about their story, why they've written something, what the background is. And with that meeting, we probably start to share mood boards of ideas. And actually, when we met Delta, we came with a set of mood boards and she came with a set of mood boards, and brilliantly they were matching images on both of those mood boards, and there was a very shared, aligned creative vision. But that's because a song like Eclipse automatically gives you a world. And I think when you're writing for Eurovision and you're thinking about the best songs in Eurovision, those ones with already a visual narrative within the lyrics helps give you a context to really anchor to. So Eclipse, obviously, you know, thinking about the moon and the sun and thinking about what happens when those two meet is a really, really great visual metaphor for what she's singing about, but also what we will bring to life on stage. So that's really, really helpful. Same for Marty with Milkshake Man. You know, there was a whole kind of storytelling there that is very useful for us on how we stage things. And this idea that, you know, he was kind of like this traveling salesman coming to town to sell you his milkshake. It was a really, really nice kind of way into it, because that's what you need. You need this kind of storytelling to really kind of draw in an audience, and we can help build that with our visual narrative.
I'm Anthony Burke, and this is a Eurovision episode of By Design on ABC Radio National. Eurovision may unfold on a stage before a live studio audience, but it is designed first and foremost for the millions watching at home. In Australia, a whopping 2.21 million of us tuned in 2025 to see our entrant Gojo perform Milkshake Man. And that number is just a drop in the ocean of the contest's global audience. Those viewers matter. Even we Australians watching in the wee hours of the morning count, because we're the ones who vote. Dr. Catherine Baker is a specialist in cultural studies at the University of Hull and co-editor of Designing Eurovision.
When you speak to producers, there is very much an ethos across the Eurovision Song Contest production that this is not a stage show which we're filming. This is a TV show, and creative decisions ultimately are all aimed at making the TV show feel as exciting and welcoming and drawing people in. So, you know, you have an audience inside the live venue, but they're part of the broadcast, essentially. They're there to contribute the kind of atmosphere that viewers at home are going to pick up on, you know, the excitement of the crowd. And in fact, there's been cases where the audience inside the venue haven't seen the full scope of what the viewers back home are seeing in terms of how the production is done. So back in 2021, the Greek entry that year had an entire green screen effect behind her. Green screen is a technique where when you are editing a broadcast, you can put in other graphics over anything that's been recorded in a particular bright green colour. So basically, when you do green screen filming, anything that is in that colour green drops out because you're going to put your own graphics on it. So the way this entry was staged, there was a green screen background and there were actually dancers in green screen morph suits so that they could have digital costumes kind of projected onto them. So if you were in that audience watching it live, what you were seeing was Stefania the singer and a whole lot of people in green morph suits dancing around behind her. And only on the TV broadcast do you actually see what that was meant to look like in its full effect. So, you know, that's an extreme example, and they haven't actually been using green screen like that. But from the production side, the priority really is the broadcast. And, you know, you'll hear people who organise Eurovision sometimes say that the best place to watch Eurovision is on your TV.
And what that can mean for a performer is a very complicated set of instructions, because Eurovision is a live television broadcast. Every moment is choreographed, not just for the arena, but for a highly sophisticated camera setup with dozens of cameras, precise movements and split-second cues that have to be hit exactly. Gojo says performing for the cameras at Eurovision was a completely new experience, requiring him to think less about the crowd in front of him and more about the lenses following his every move.
I think there was like over 20 cameras in there, and they were all like in the crowd, and the only way that you could recognize them was through this tiny little red dot. So you had to like try and find it And then, you know, we would do the first rehearsal is the first time that we knew where all the cameras were, because you kind of don't really have an idea before that. I remember the first rehearsal we did on the stage. I remember, like, you know, I'm hearing, like, in my ear, like, camera one. And I'm like, where is that? Because there's so many everywhere, you know. And then it was after rehearsal one that we kind of could really fine comb the intricate parts of the performance. Performing to the cameras is much more important than performing to the arena, because most people are watching from home.
From ABC Radio National, you're listening to By Design. I'm Anthony Burke, and in this episode, the spotlight is on design and the telespectacular that is the Eurovision Song Contest. If you look back at the very first Eurovision broadcasts, you'll see a rather modest setup. A small stage, a singer, and a mic stand. Pretty basic. But over the years, the stages have become larger and more elaborate, the tech getting more complex and sophisticated. Today, one of the key and most widely used tools in the Eurovision set designer's toolbox is the LED screen. Dr. Catherine Baker again.
I think this is probably the most distinctive change if you look at Eurovision of the last 15 years compared to if you see contests up to the early millennium. What we've seen with the screens over the last 15 years is the size has improved, the resolution has massively improved. You can do incredibly immersive stuff with it now.
These days, Eurovision stages are essentially tiled with LED screens, a virtual playground for designers to use in their storytelling. For creative designers Dan Shipton and Ross Nicholson, video production is an important element of their design narrative. Dan again.
The process of Eurovision, once you get outside of the mood board stage, is actually very, very detailed. Obviously, we need to move to full technical drawings and design very, very quickly. And all of those have to be submitted to the contest team on the host broadcaster and approved. So the design process is very much, I guess, like you would design a house. You have your ideas, you have your mood boards of what it'll look like. Then you have to turn them into actuality. So that goes for all the technical drawings for your props and the things that are going to get made. Then we start looking at the other elements that are going to play into the technical elements we have at hand to make our magic. So, of course, video is a really big part of that. The video is something that we design in-house at Black Skull and becomes almost like the tool to kind of create a picture, essentially, right? So it's our backdrop. So that becomes really, really important. And all of the performances are run to time code. So that time code is the thing that is the backbone to everything. So our lighting is locked to it, our video is locked to it, Delta or Marty is locked to it, and that it allows the accents within the music to be expressed in everything that we're doing, both from a lighting design point of view, video design point of view, and everything that we want from staging point of view. So every detail is completely worked out. But then the most important thing, I think, is how we translate it on camera, because the 180 million people watching are watching via a TV. So we then also script on a thing called Live Edit, which is a tool which is completely automated camera cut. And we get to do that as a nation. We get to provide our camera cut and we're in complete control of what camera is used when. Obviously, there's the realities of how that all kind of plays out in the actual rehearsal process, and it changes and develops, but we get to put that in and we get to give our kind of first stab at that. That is also completely tied to the rehearsal process we've had with the artist. So for us as directors, it's about bringing the whole thing together.
Ross, do you want to jump in there? And I'm just sort of curious about what you think maybe the most technically difficult part of the whole process is?
It's hard to say, really. I think it differs depending on what the kind of what the creative is and how technical each performance is and how we want to push that. But I guess for us, it's probably the coming together of all those elements and making sure that they all sit together on that timeline and they all complement each other is probably the most challenging aspect.
Yeah, I thought you might have said, you know, engaging the latest upgrades in LED technology or something like that. But actually, it's more of the integration of the creatives that you've got to bring together as the team to make it all work together.
Yeah. Like when we're working on such a big scale, like you don't often see all of the elements of your performance come together until like you get your stand-in rehearsal, for instance. So how they do it at Eurovision, prior to our arrival on site, the host broadcaster, they'll create a mock-up of your performance with a stand-in performer, with lighting, with camera shots, with your prop, with all the elements, your video content, and then they send that video to you, and then you review the video in advance of your arrival, give all your notes, and then when you get to your first rehearsal, you've kind of got a bit of a head start because you've given notes on like a first pass. So that's quite often the first time that you're seeing that. So it's whether or not that works, that particular thing works, or that piece of staging kind of works the way in which you intended. So that's quite a nerve-wracking moment in the process, and it is super exciting, but it can be quite challenging at times.
We also think about technology as a story enabler, an emotional connector. Shouldn't be the thing that sits forefront and center, because ultimately that feels very cold for an audience. So for us, if we're getting comments on technology, then we've kind of failed at our jobs, I think. Ultimately, we should be making people feel something and be emotionally connected to our artists and the story that they're telling through their song. And all and every bit of the process is all about technology, but it should never be the star of the show.
I'm Anthony Burke, and you're listening to ABC Radio National's By Design. Eurovision is known for its big dramatic sets and costumes. Over the years, there's been everything from a giant hamster wheel rolling across the stage to fireworks. And of course, there was our own Kate Miller-Heike performing on stilts. So are there any rules around what you can do on Eurovision? For musician Gojo, he couldn't get everything he wanted for his performance of Milkshake Man.
One of the questions I had was, can we have live animals on the stage? And that was an instant no. No live animals. And also I asked if we could have like milk, but there was no liquids on stage either.
Dr. Catherine Baker says that water has been consistently on the contraband list, but the rules can and do change from year to year.
It will depend on the capabilities of the particular venue that they've chosen, for instance. But one rule that's been in place most of the time is you can't have water effects on stage, for instance. There's been a few years where there have been. So, you know, you might remember the Irish band Jedward, who were in it a couple of times, and they had one of their songs was called Waterfall, so they had one. But I think especially with staging getting more complex and there being quite literally sometimes more moving parts in what needs to be moved on and off for each of your performances, you can't take the risk of having loose water on stage.
For designers Ross and Dan at Black Skull Creative, rules can force them to be more inventive. With strict guidelines around safety, budgets, timing, and camera lines, every creative choice has to work harder, often leading to smarter, more original design solutions than total freedom ever would.
There are also rules in place at Eurovision that also mean that there are things that we can achieve other places that we can't achieve there. So, you know, things like we can only have 6 performers on stage. When we design at the Brit Awards, we can have hundreds of performers on stage. So that's a complete difference. We also have to set our prop or our staging elements on stage within 30 to 40 seconds. And so that is also a big consideration. As we design, we have to be able to fit within a very strict set of rules. And if we don't achieve those rules, then the competition has the ability to say no to our ideas, and therefore that's a restriction that means it's a creative restriction that has to be very considered. So because of those rules, it sets you up for driving in a certain direction that you might not have to do if you're doing another TV show and you might have 5 to 10 minutes to set your ideas on stage, you know?
Just to add to that, there's obviously like a weight restriction as to what the sum total of your set pieces can weigh, and then how many set pieces you can have as well. But I think you could go into this thinking about that as a negative, or like, oh no, it's really restrictive. But actually, I think as creatives and as designers, having those parameters placed upon us, I think sometimes it can drive you to be more creative or think about things in a different way, which is really exciting. I think if you were given free rein to do absolutely anything you want, whilst that's obviously exciting, sometimes it's the restriction and the parameters that kind of create the best output.
With all of your experience at Eurovision in mind, have you got any favourite set designs that you should point us to where you go, that was absolutely the bomb, that one? That was the best I've ever seen.
Our own designs aside, I would say for me, Loreen Loreen Tattoo was like one of the best performances that I've seen on the Eurovision stage, and I loved what they did for that. That was an interesting one as well, because what the creative in the set that they had for their national final was a lot bigger scale, and obviously having to then bring that design and fit within the rules of Eurovision, it meant they had to scale that particular design down. And I think they did a really great job of maintaining the creative integrity of that within that, but it was obviously like a smaller piece. But I just thought the, in terms of everything coming together and how the camera worked with that and the kind of the world that created was such a winning performance. Obviously it did go on to win, and that was one of my favourites.
It's interesting, Ross uses the word world, and we do often talk about on Eurovision creating worlds, ultimately because we are given all of the same tools as every other creator that comes to that stage. You have to ask yourself, during your design process, how much of all of the same tools do you want to use? Because if you can choose to use everything, but then everyone can use everything. So quite often we actually start with a blank canvas and we almost turn everything off and then only add when we really need to add for our layers in our storytelling. And we're doing a couple of performances this year for different countries. And you have someone like Delta, where we start very small but build to massive scale in the end. We have another performance for Malta. And that is completely turning all the screens off in the venue and really closing it down to a prop that literally creates a world around the artist. So every song requires a different design story, but it is interesting when you start thinking about it from a competition point of view. Do you use every tool and paintbrush that everyone else has, or do you bring your own in, and how can that change your way of kind of relating to an audience?
At its heart, Eurovision is a live TV event that we don't just watch, we take part in too. We vote in real time, react in real time, and without fabulous stage design, we wouldn't be glued to our sets. I know I'm there for the show and the spectacular, not the music. And that's one of Eurovision's biggest design achievements, creating a single stage that can handle dozens of performances, work flawlessly on camera, and still make more than 160 million people feel like they're united in a shared moment. Dr. Catherine Baker again.
If I was to say what's been the biggest single technological impact that Eurovision has had, I would go right back to the fact that you need to not just organise broadcasting a contest and sending it out to what can be more than 50 different TV markets at once, but from the mid-1990s onwards, you've also had to coordinate the voting sequence where you don't just have the people presenting the voting phoning in, like you used to do, but you actually have them on satellite link. So you've got to get in these satellite links from every country which is presenting votes. And in the contemporary Eurovision Grand Final, now that is going to be, this year it's going to be 35 countries. There's been years before when it's been 40 plus. All of those satellite links have got to work first time. And at the same time, behind the scenes, there is this huge process going on to collecting the public votes. So the complexity behind the scenes, getting all those satellite links in order for the voting to be seamless and for viewers to have what's supposed to be voting, it's supposed to be this kind of exciting, climactic experience. Nothing else like Eurovision has had to do that in the same way.
From its inception in 1956, Eurovision has set out to foster cultural exchange through music. The 2026 theme, United by Music in the Heart of Europe, continues that tradition. But strip away the branding, and at the end of the day, this is still a fiercely competitive contest, right? Dan Shipton from Black Skull Creative.
We had dinner last night with a lot of the other creatives, actually, that are behind other countries. And we kind of all said, actually, whilst it is a competition, it's such a shared moment and we all love coming together. So ultimately, we're happy whoever wins, you know, but ultimately you still want your country to do well. And when you're sat there on the grand final night and all the votes coming in, it's very exciting. And, you know, you have that drive to win. But ultimately, we're there to, I don't know, bring joy to the world. So it's also, you know, it's lovely. But yes, you obviously want to do well.
It's such a lovely community, and you know, it's a long journey as well. You know, these people are doing the like tours and press events and kind of parties and all up in the run-up. So there are the really nice connections that people make, and people are friends, and people do want each other to do well. So there's obviously, there is that competitive edge, and that, you know, everyone wants to win, but like Dan said, everyone is super happy for each other, and kind of, it's a very supportive, collaborative world.
I think what you have is, it's a real global moment. It's a moment where people actually come together. There's not many of those moments that are activated by entertainment anymore. I think they are for sports events, because but this feels like the sporting event of the music world, I guess, because it is a shared moment. And I think that's also a gift to give to an audience as well. You know, it's bringing people together for this moment of joy and spectacle and emotion. And we were talking to Delta about this yesterday, but the idea that we as a team can give this gift to an Australian audience, that they can join and they sit there for 3 hours in the hope that they might have this moment of winning. Wherever you come, it's just this absolute joy of being united in that shared belief for a moment. And that's a gift, I think.
Dan Shipton, creative director at Black Skull. Eurovision may once have been dismissed as niche entertainment, but today there's nothing quite like it in terms of scale and complexity and sheer spectacle in live television. The Eurovision stage is engineered to let creatives from around the world flex their imaginations, bringing together technology and ambition on a truly global platform. The Eurovision stage is at once a designer's dream and nightmare. All creative opportunity, but within an insane technical context for a rapidly evolving media and entertainment landscape. Watching the designers at work and hearing them talk just brings to light the enormously diverse skills designers are working with in these high-pressure environments, all while somehow still managing to bring smiles to the faces of 160 million people around the globe every year. What's the best design moment from Eurovision that you've ever witnessed? Shoot me a line. Our email is bydesign@abc.net.au. And thanks so much for your emails, as ever. We had a great response to our episode on neurodivergent friendly design. Amanda wrote in about the overwhelming lights and sounds in supermarkets and says, I'm aware of low sensory hours in chain supermarkets, but why, oh why, wouldn't they want all customers to be relaxed enough to spend more time spending their money there? Good point, Amanda. Supermarkets, take note. This is By Design. Make sure you follow the podcast so you'll get future episodes. And watch out for our bonus series, Extraordinary Everyday, released every Thursday. Next time on By Design, I'll be speaking with Australian interior design legend Mary Featherston, all about the state of Australian design today. So come back for that on the next episode of By Design, because in a rapidly changing world, design matters. The producer of By Design is Siobhan Hunt. The program was produced on Gadigal land and the lands of the Wurundjeri.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.